and welcome to episode 11 of Awin Talks, the affiliate marketing podcast. It's been a busy month at Awin, with two of our big annual conferences being held this month, one in the US and one in the UK. Think Tank is the name we've given to these annual get-togethers, and for those of you familiar with our Share a Sale arm, you'll know that that's the name they've used for their popular yearly conference for some time. It's a good name, and we've nabbed it now. I was lucky enough to attend and participate in both of our 2019 Think Tanks, and I have to say they were both hugely successful, with some brilliant speakers, fascinating discussions, and an array of different businesses coming together to meet, network, learn from each other, and make plans to collaborate, making it a hugely valuable event to be a part of. If you couldn't make it along though, fear not, because today's episode features a variety of recorded excerpts from some of the sessions at each of the conferences to help give you a taste of what you missed out on, hear from a variety of industry experts, and hopefully entice you to come along next time. We'll kick off with the US Think Tank, which took place in Chicago and where I interviewed live on stage a trio of contributors to this year's Awin Report about the content they provided us with and asked them about their respective fields of expertise. First up was Thijs van Santen, Chief Revenue Officer at Button. Button are a mobile partnership platform for some of the world's leading brands and help Awin's clients forge connections with affiliates that track across mobile environments, including within apps. Button contributed to our US chapter within the Awin Report, and I asked Thijs about how the adoption of mobile technology has transformed e-commerce and the ways in which consumers interact with advertisers online.
So I think that it's no secret to anyone that we spend, you know, a lot of time on our mobile phones. In fact, in 2018, on average, we spent twice as much time on our mobile phones as we did on desktop. Yet commerce and purchasing behavior has stayed behind, and that's because it's been very difficult to create enticing experiences for consumers and actually make it easy for them to buy, as well as like instill the trust that you want to have, you know, with the consumer to effectively buy on your platform. Yep, we're seeing that change, right? So last year, this global discretionary spend grew with about 7%, e-commerce grew with 15%, yet mobile commerce grew with 40%. So you see that, you know, there's a real trend going on there, which is fueled with, you know, changing demographics, of course, you know, the evolution of the ecosystem, apps, more attention on apps and websites, as well as the adoption of mobile wallets, which I think is going to be a massive driver for users to become more used to buying, you know, with their mobile devices. What's interesting is, for those of you that are from London, it's very common for you to pay for the tube, which we call the subway in New York, with your mobile phone. And for those of you that are in New York, you probably start seeing that, you know, that's being rolled out there as well. So we're getting increasingly used to using our, you know, mobile device as a payment a payment method. And with that, it's becoming more of a buying environment. The other interesting thing is, if you look at, and I have to peek here, Amazon, Walmart, eBay, and Target, of all the time that was spent on mobile, between 77 and 85% was actually spent in app. So again, if you look across those four brands, 77 to 85% of the time that, you know, consumers spend on their properties is on an app versus versus web. So there's increasing focus on getting your, you know, customers to become an app user, because app users are, you know, much more loyal users. And the way to think about this is like the prime position you want to be as an app is on that first page. It's almost like, you know, the Google results. If you're not on the first page, then, you know, your relevance, you know, drops significantly. So you see that a lot of brands are waking up to the fact that, you know, in order to bring, to build sustainable, you know, profitable relationships with consumers, they need to do that, you know, through a whole host of channels. I'm not saying that desktop and offline are not relevant. In fact, they are very relevant. Yet mobile is a key entry point, because it's a device that you always have with you. It's very personal. So there's a strong indicator there. Let me see. I wrote a few other things down. Then the last thing that I think is worth mentioning is that mWeb remains an important channel as well, and it's particularly to still capture search traffic, right? So although users, like typically in the desktop world, intent started like with Google, right? So you would go onto your computer and you would look for something, and that would take you somewhere. today that doesn't happen anymore. So consumers are increasingly going directly to an app and where they have like a purpose. So whether it's a TripAdvisor app, you know, to look for, you know, a good deal in a hotel or to kayak, to look for a flight and so forth and so forth. But if the app is not there, then consumers still, you know, use search. And search typically leads to, actually almost always leads to Amber properties. Google does not like to send the user away into an app. And so Amber properties are key to convert a user from an Amber user to an app user. Mm.
No, I was just going to say that kind of concept of mobile commerce is something that's really central, isn't it, to the kind of Button's own publication. Yes. More recently, you've just published a new white paper, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of real central.
Like to quote the report.
Yeah.
We talk about like building a commerce strategy to publishers, and we talk to brands about, you know, really leveraging commerce versus advertising to engage and acquire new users. Now, I'm speaking to an audience that is obviously very familiar with this, right? So affiliate has really been built on the premise of, you know, remunerating, you know, the source of traffic, you know, when a transaction has completed. And so from that perspective, it's really not that new. What we're seeing in mobile is that a lot of the, you know, the traditional publishers, you know, are still like stuck with that old like way of thinking and, you know, thinking about display, you know, impressions and ads, which are effectively not working, right? So I think there's a question later about tracking, mm-hmm. but obviously there are tracking issues. There's tons of fraud issues that are, you know, they're not just fake impressions, but it's even attribution fraud. There's just a ton of like issues that, you know, advertisers and publishers run into. And more importantly for publishers, you know, typically ads are just annoying, right? So there is very limited real estate that you have on the screen. And more often than not, you just don't want to see that ad or you don't want to see that video. And because everybody is all about viewability and like making sure that, you know, you see it, they'll make sure you see it. As in, you know, just look for that button to kind of like, where's that X where I can get rid of this with this ad. And as a result, you know, users spend less time on those publisher properties. So it's kind of like a downward spiral. So what Button believes is that if you build a commerce strategy, which is much more aligning, your actions or the buttons, right? Guess where the name came from? with the intent of the user, is you can create a much more relevant experience, but ultimately benefits both the publisher and the brand, right? So good examples are, you know, we work with Foursquare. Foursquare is one of our publishers, and typically people go into Foursquare to look, like, how do I go somewhere? They look for a review for a restaurant, and so forth, and so forth. So if you look at a restaurant, it's likely that you want to go there or you want to eat, right? So that's one. And then you may want to get food from that restaurant. So we serve, you know, a caviar button or a Postmates button. But we also serve an open table button because you might actually want to, you know, book a table there and, you know, make sure that you get to eat that night. And then if you're not, you know, not too close by, we serve an Uber or Lyft button to take you there. So in other words, you know, where you could see those buttons as ads, but they're not, right? So they're highly relevant, they're contextual, and they're, you know, they're enhancing the experience for the user. And as a result, what happens is that the utility of Foursquare, you know, and the relevance actually grows, right? So they see more engagement and user usage within their app. And at the same time, you know, Uber sees more bookings, OpenTable sees more bookings. Caviar, you know, has the ability to, you know, both engage with new users as well as existing users. So, and everybody wins.
After speaking to Tice, I invited Kim Westwood, Managing Director at ShoppingLinks, an influencer marketing platform that Awin collaborates with, up on stage. And I started by asking Kim about her guest article in this year's Awin report, which focused on how influencer marketing has evolved in recent years and been adopted by the affiliate channel.
And your article essentially does kind of chart the professionalization of the influencer channel and how, yeah, I guess, affiliate marketing and the adoption of influencers within that channel has kind of helped to contribute, I guess, to that professionalization.
Yeah, and I think that that's a really important point because I think the affiliate networks have really helped to drive an understanding of the performance of the channel. So we've had, and we still do have, huge amounts of budget being spent with digital parts of the business, PR parts of the business, social parts of the business, content parts of the business, with no performance tracking. And where we've seen really good success with brands that we've worked with over a number of years is when all parts of those businesses work more closely together. So if we can get, you know, some sort of affiliate tracking on a PR activity around gifting influencers, then we've been able to see, well, which influencers are then performing and which ones aren't. Mm-hmm. And that's really important for a brand to be able to see that. You know, it is about conversion. I appreciate that there's branding activity as well around reach and impressions, but I think the professionalization has really come from how we're able to track that performance and how we can continue to track that performance.
Yeah. The last click model, obviously, that is so inherent to the channel, that's been quite an obstacle, obviously, for these publishers that have come in and whose activity is naturally that much further up the kind of general research funnel as far as e-commerce is concerned. So, I mean, how do you see affiliate kind of evolving to help, I guess, incentivize properly those influencers?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because we still see influencers driving a lot of that new customer acquisition, first click. I haven't, across all the networks, I haven't had, you know, any experience with attribution working. So that for me would be like, you know, a really key piece is how do we get attribution really embedded for every advertiser, for every sub-network. You know, how can we really start to reward those influencers in a different way than just flat fee payments? You know, obviously we've migrated to flat fees because we haven't been able to really put like some good measures around, you know, that sort of first click, middle click, last click conversion. But I think that that's one thing that we collectively need to do more on is, you know, how do we start to look at attribution throughout the channel, you know, and throughout the, you know, influencer, you know, driving different customers. And
so if for advertisers that maybe haven't kind of dabbled in influencer marketing before, and particularly through their kind of affiliate programs, I mean, what kind of advice or recommendations would you necessarily have for them in terms of kind of reaching out, engaging, setting up their program to ensure that they are providing the right kinds of incentives that they can engage with them properly?
Yeah, I think with influencer, it's not affiliate. And I think that, you know, I'm the first one to say it's the most closely aligned and we need to be, you know, really working together more on how influencer intersects affiliate. I think for advertisers, often we see that they're really wanting that ROI, they're really wanting the last click traffic, and influencer just doesn't generally provide that. But what we have learned over the years is there are a number of strategies from the affiliate channel that you can apply to influencer to get a greater level of conversion. So we would always start with, you know, what is the objective? You know, is it content? Is it SEO? Is it more traffic? Is it more sales? If it is sales and you are wanting to drive traffic and sales as via content or via influencer, we would really say, you know, start to apply some of the strategies that work with affiliates. So we've seen, for example, when we work with an influencer, the influencer promotes the brand, they may not drive any, you know, great sales. As soon as we offer a conversion incentive, such as a discount code, free shipping, some sort of incentive for the influencer's audience to convert, then we see a huge uplift in sales and traffic. So we would say think about some of those strategies and applying some of those things. I think also working more collectively across the marketing function within your business. So again, we see brands who are just looking for the traffic and sales, but they're not necessarily looking at how they can repurpose the influencer imagery. So L2 here in the States did some research on the number of brands who were using influencer and those who were actually repurposing the content. And they found that 10% of brands were repurposing the content. And we know when we've studied brands and the brands that we work with that they can get a 33% increase in click-through rate, a 22% increase in sales when they use that influencer imagery via an EDM or a CRM newsletter. In some cases, 59% uplift on site sales if they're using the influencer imagery. So really looking across the business as opposed to just looking at the affiliate conversion, but working together with PR, working together with digital, and starting to say, okay, we've had a gifting campaign across a PR activity. How can we get that affiliate team to then start to be tracking the performance of those influencers rather than just gifting product and not knowing, you know, who is performing and who's not performing?
Finally, I spoke to Gary Keibel, a partner at Davis & Gilbert Attorneys at Law and also Awin's legal counsel for the US market. Long-time Awin Talks listeners may recognise Gary's voice as he spoke to us more generally about the state of US digital regulation in Episode 4. But this time he spoke to me specifically about the impending California Consumer Privacy Act, the implications of that new law, and how it actually compares to Europe's own data law, GDPR.
Many of you may have heard that there's this new law coming into effect called the California Consumer Privacy Act, CCPA. And it's a big deal in the United States because we've never had a comprehensive privacy law on the federal or state level that applies to all activities regarding personal information. We've had laws that target different sectors, children's information or financial information or health information, but there's never been this comprehensive law that covers everything. And some people have compared it to GDPR, and there are similarities. But the key thing about the California law is that it applies to all personal information, and it gives consumers a right to access their personal information so they can contact you and ask you to delete it, update it, give them a copy of their data. And it also requires you to give a consumer the right to opt out of certain transfers of that data. Now, as we sit here today, those rights don't exist. The law takes effect in 2020. Right now, if a consumer reached out to your company and said, I want to know what personal information you have about me, unless you had said something in your privacy policy that gave the consumer that right, you'd have the right to say, I'm not going to give you that information. Or if they reached out to you and said, I want you to delete everything you know about me, you'd have a right now to say, I'm not going to do that. I want to keep that data. But this law is going to change all of that. Now, one important thing to keep in mind is this is an opt-out law, unless you're dealing with children. But it's an opt-out law. So this does not require you to get opt-in consent from every consumer in order to process their personal information. But once you do get their information, you now have certain obligations under the law to allow consumers to access it. And then if you transfer it to other parties, under the law, it's called a sale, and you intuitively think, well, I don't sell personal information. But the law defines sale extremely broadly. If you have a Google Analytics tag on your site, you might be deemed to be selling personal information to Google because you're collecting tracking cookies and unique identifiers, and it's going to Google, even though technically it's going directly to them. Under the law, that might be a sale. So there are going to be a lot of new obligations that are going to be imposed on U.S. companies that they've never had to deal with before.
This is a state-level piece of legislation with specific kind of remit for California citizens, though. And so do you think that this is something that other state legislatures are going to be looking at with a view to kind of enacting their own legislation and perhaps even the government from a federal level as well?
Sure. So, yes, this is a state law. It is a California state law, and it applies to California residents. Now, if you do business online, it's kind of hard to avoid California, right? I mean, it's like the seventh largest economy in the world independently. And from the clients I speak to, I'm not coming across any clients who say that they're going to treat a California person different than someone from Oregon. So they're going to put in place compliance procedures, and next year, if that California resident or the Oregon resident contacts them, they're going to give them the same rights. It's almost more complicated to have different rights for people in different states. And to your point about what's happening elsewhere, other states are getting on the bandwagon here. There are many other states that are passing and considering laws about this transparency and consumer access rights. Actually, Nevada just passed a law which takes effect before 2020, before CCPA, although it's a little narrower. And New York is working on a law as well. So you're going to see these popping up all over the place, and it's going to be hard to ignore them. Now, on the federal level, will the federal government come in and wipe out all these crazy state laws and put in one federal law? I don't know. Industry would love that. But, you know, our Congress is sometimes a little bit inept and can't get things done. So while there's a lot of talk about that, I don't suspect that's going to happen soon.
I mean, these issues are obviously hugely pertinent right now, right across the world, not just obviously in America. And we've obviously had GDPR in Europe over the last kind of couple of years. But Do you think that these localized regulation, I guess I mean that from a nationwide or continental perspective, it runs the risk of hindering the success and growth of online businesses that obviously are profoundly borderless in a way. They're interacting with consumers right across the globe. So do you think that that's going to be an issue? I've heard kind of the use of the word of this kind of balkanization of the internet, and that regulation like this does potentially kind of run the risk of displacing and fragmenting the global e-commerce industry.
Yeah, I would say it's bad for everybody except for one group of people, privacy lawyers. It's kind of the Full Employment Act for us. But it is very complex for everyone else. How do you deal with different standards all over, of course, the world, and then even in different states? So, you know, you have to go, you know, to the strictest standard that you can find in your jurisdiction. And, you know, we deal with this in other industries. You know, I deal with clients that are doing global sweepstakes. And you've got different sweepstakes laws in different countries, and they vary. And if you're doing a global promotion, you have to go in these different countries and make sure that you comply. The hope is that a lot of these standards will be similar. Like I said, CCPA is similar to GDPR in some respects, but it's different in other respects. So it's making the compliance efforts much more challenging, which is why there is a push to try to get a federal privacy law that would preempt California, preempt the other states. But I think politically, it's probably unlikely. I mean, California is really latching on to their law. The Speaker of the House is from California, and she said she's not going to allow something that will preempt California. The two senators from California in the Senate said they were not going to allow preemption there. So I think it's very likely California is going to happen. Something will happen on the federal level, but I don't think it's going to get rid of the California obligation.
You mentioned actually just in reference to GDPR and the differences there. What are the primary differences between the two forms of legislation?
So under GDPR, there's a lot of differences, but I'll just give you a few examples. Yeah. So under GDPR, you need to have a legal basis to process personal information of an individual. It could be you got consent. It could be you have what's called a legitimate interest. It could be that you have to process the data to perform a contract. But you need to basically justify your right to process personal information. Again, California is an opt-out law. You don't have to justify the reason you have the personal information. You do have to make sure you didn't steal it or, you know, get it under false pretenses, but you're allowed to collect personal information. You don't have to justify the reason. GDPR also focuses a lot on internal data security at a company, whereas CCPA, the California law, is really focused on the consumer and giving rights to the consumer.
If you're keen to read more on Gary's views on digital legislation and its effects upon the affiliate industry, you can find those in our legislation chapter of the Awin Report, where he appears alongside our legal counsels for the UK and Italy. Now, we're going to jet across the Atlantic from Chicago to London and drop in on our UK think tank conference, which was held a week later and featured a packed schedule of content that started with a comical keynote from Delta Poll's Joe Twyman, that discussed Brexit voting patterns and the value of big data in informing decisions around strategy. From there, the event involved talks from a variety of Awin staff across the business, many of whom were completely new to the experience of public speaking, and they provided some unique takes on a range of pertinent industry topics. The importance of authenticity in influencer marketing, future-proofing technology in the affiliate channel, how high street retail has been disrupted by online shopping. These were just some of the subjects and topics discussed on the day, and all the speakers did a fantastic job. We're going to listen to a little excerpt now from the last session of the day, though, featuring a panel discussion with Awin's board and its UK country manager, Ian Charlesworth. Lisa Hammond, Awin's group marketing director, chaired the session, and she started by asking each of them about their own personal highlight from the last 12 months.
So to kick off, and we are going to get to some Slido questions as well, but we have a few things that we wanted to kind of cover off first. So we've seen a lot of content today, a lot of great insight into the work that's being done across the network. Can each of you share in 60 seconds or less, what's your biggest highlight across the last 12 months? We'll start with you, Ian.
Okay, so the biggest highlight for me is actually something we didn't talk about today. As you all probably know, a while ago we acquired ShareASale, and that's a really interesting business model for us, and obviously very successful domestically in the US. But there's parts of that business model that are attractive to us outside of the US. So In the last 12 months, in the UK, we've been understanding what aspects of that business model could be ported over to the UK to really open up the channel for even smaller brands and SMEs. And we've kind of done this as a stealth project under the radar. And I'm really proud to say that we've got just over 100 really, really small brands that are now making money, driving sales, attracting publishers on the AWIN network in a kind of Shearer Sale-esque model. And so I'm really, I think that's great to sort of flourish grassroots e-commerce in the UK. And I think from that pool of really small brands, there'll obviously be the next big Gymshark or Pretty Little Thing of the next decade. So that, I'm really proud of that. I think the team's done an amazing job.
Excellent. Pete?
And so for me, it's sort of two things that are somewhat related, which is, first of all, the successful integration of AffiliNet, which has meant that we have a development team, or they have a development team in Hanover, and we've now brought that team in, and they're now contributing to the AWIN platform, which in turn has then led to a return to more external focus in terms of our development effort and our product development effort. So after a few years of being quite internally focused around integration of platforms, we're now seeing, as you saw from the presentations earlier today, a more sort of customer-focused approach in product development as well.
So maybe a little bit contentious, I'm going to say GDPR and e-privacy. The reason why is the internet didn't collapse and e-commerce didn't die. The reality of this, and why I'm kind of like happy and why I put it as a highlight, is affiliate marketing is relatively data light. It is wholly compliant. It operates on a cost of sale basis. I have an absolute love affair with it. I think it is the best form of online marketing, e-commerce. And I think on this basis, the reason why I'm happy about GDPR and e-privacy is there are a number of bad actors. There's a lot of things happening within the digital marketplace that we do need to identify, that we do need to eliminate. And I think, you know, with the progress, I don't want to put it in the hands of politicians. It does need to be in the hands of consumers, and it does need to be in the hand of ethical players like ourselves to manage this expectation and make sure that what we're delivering for consumers, what we're delivering for our retailers and our publishers is not just compliant, but more forward thinking. Data has a place to play, but only if it's handled in the right kind of way.
Well, for me, apart from Liverpool winning the Champions League last week, yes, it has got to be the realization of a sort of long-term strategy of ours, which is this solutions marketplace, or the addition of the publisher master tag, the advertiser master tag, and the great innovation that we're seeing from so many different technology players in the industry, and how we're able to bring those in an easy and seamless way to all our partners. And I think, you know, there's great things that are going to come from that, but I really see it as a sort of a way that the industry can evolve from where it is today into something much more exciting.
Great, thanks for that. So Pete, just coming back to you on that, because we had the session from the product team on future-proofing of the channel. Can you talk to us a little bit from a technology perspective, what we're doing to safeguard the industry and our advertisers and partners?
Sure. So, yeah, I think Stephen and Mahela obviously did a great presentation earlier, I think, covering, first of all, in terms of the work that we're doing around tracking. And obviously that's about protecting commissions to publishers and also the revenue stream to our advertisers as well. So that's obviously a big part of what we're doing, making sure that tracking is future-proofed and works in a compliant way, which matches what consumers are now expecting from us as well. And then the other aspect is around the master tag, and I think this then goes into the solutions marketplace, and I think really the opportunity there is about providing this sort of ecosystem where publishers, advertisers, and technology providers can all work together and benefit from that network effect. So it's this, as Ian mentioned earlier, it's this sort of transformation from us being a network to a platform. And then what does that mean for us? So what's the value add that we can do there? And I think that's very much around us acting as a trusted partner there, and being able to deal with some of the questions around privacy and data governance and contract management and those sorts of pieces as well. And then finally, I think the other pieces around what we want to do around the sort of, well, for our enterprise clients as well, and sort of looking at that real top end of the market in terms of the sort of larger advertisers. And again, I think that we want to do that in a in an Awin way, which is trying to maintain that balance that we've always had between the needs of the publisher and the advertiser as well, to make sure that we bring that to the mix, and that we can develop in that direction in a way that that respects what it is that the publishers want from a network as well.
Great. That actually ties really nicely in with two questions that have come in on Slido. I was just noticing, actually, can we add Slido on the screen so actually all the audience can see and perfect. So we're going off of most voted. So the first one was that we heard Ian mention about how the industry might evolve, and what do you see as the role of the network in 2019, and how do you expect to see this change? And I think that kind of ties in nicely with a question from Helen on, we've seen a trend towards the separation of tech and service and affiliate marketing. How do you see Awin adapting to this in the future, or do you need to? Anyone want to take a stab at that?
I'll take an initial stab. In some ways, I think it can be seen as a little bit misleading. I think when you look at the network, everybody has a traditional concept idea. To some degree, it's actually been played down. It's actually been seen as kind of like a legacy element. It's this idea that you have the technology, you have the service, and you have the reach, and it's all incorporated in one kind of package. And then you actually have individual players who basically say, well, no, we'll separate it out. We'll look at the technology as a separate element, and then we'll treat the service as a separate element. And likewise, as Adam and Peter have mentioned, we'll also look at third-party tech innovators as a separate entity as well, and then beyond that, cross-border reach. For me, I think the reality is that this has always existed. We've had any number of retailers who've used us to whatever degree they want. They can use us purely for our tracking and our reach. In many instances, they can use us for our strategic insights for a cross-border global expansion, or they can use us for third-party tech. The advantages that we have within all of that is we basically are able to compare the performance of how it works for one sector, one retailer, create the kind of benchmarking, create that kind of transparency, and actually do it in a very open and compliant fashion. I do honestly feel that the concept of the network would actually be an evolutionary step. If we'd have had it before where it was just pure tracking, if we'd have had it before where we'd have had a separate operation looking at service, there would have been a natural merging of that kind of setup. Now, that's not to say that we don't have specialist agencies that we work with, acceleration partners. So Helen raised that question. I think that's a classic example of one that operates more traditionally in the US market, but has now expanded to operate globally. And that's something that if it fits the purpose for our clients, then by all means, we'll embrace it. But it really does depend what our clients are actually looking for and what we can deliver based on where they're operating.
Yeah, I think there's some there's an element of perhaps spin that's happening in the industry that's making it seem like the traditional affiliate network is a different business model, and it's kind of had its time, and things are evolving into more of a SaaS and technology centric world, which I find it frankly ridiculous, because we all deliver our technology as software as a service. So to position SaaS versus non-SaaS as if it's some sort of binary world, for me, I find it quite offensive and a little bit annoying. And I think what we need to do is to steal back some of that narrative from the market and really showcase the fact that we have existed in this hybrid world. It's a continuum that flexes based on what our clients are looking for. You know, that can be pure technology, as Mark said, or it could be full service. And also that flexes country to country and over different time periods. And so I think we perhaps need to do a slightly more aggressive job and a better job in terms of communicating that the affiliate network is not a different business model. It's not a different technology, fundamentally a different technology ecosystem, and that we're very comfortable working in these kind of hybrid environments and have done for many years.
Yeah, I'm just going to add to that. I mean, the point that you make there about this idea of marketing spin, And I think we know, for any of those people who've been in the industry, there are going to be a number of players, predominantly within the kind of like software as a service market, who want to basically have this marketing spin. And I don't blame them. You know, they're making a market entry. They want to basically, you know, drive their business. They want to basically create top line revenue for their private equity partners. But the reality is it affiliate marketing? Is it partner marketing? You know, if you go back long enough, I think originally with the concept of Amazon, which kind of came up with that concept, they were Amazon partners. It was the affiliate model. Affiliate marketing isn't dead. Cost per acquisition is the most transparent, accountable means for actually driving value. The bit that changes with that is the other performance models that you can put attached to that, other payment models. That's the bit that we're looking at. It's all part of an evolution. It's not a direct sea change. It's just overall transparency for everybody having a mechanism and an ecosystem that suits whatever it is they want to drive.
I think you've just answered the most requested question as well about the affiliate marketing being dead and partner marketing being the future and giving thoughts on that. So you've already answered that one.
Well, I'd just like to add to that as well, because that whole thing particularly annoys me, because the idea is that somehow if we rebrand ourselves, if we become, you know, a new name, that this is somehow going to drive investment into the industry, into the channel. And nothing could be further from the truth. This is not the problem that we have. I think, you know, we have other problems with the way things are tracked, with making sure that program environments are appealing and are conducive to growth. And I think we need to focus on those things and making sure that the value that affiliates can drive is clearly understood by brands. It's not about a simple thing like a name change or denigrating one name in favor of another. It's about focusing on the things that will drive program investment and improvement. And in doing that, we'll attract more investment into the channel and attract more partners and start actually having a conversation at a more senior level inside the brands.
A massive thanks to everyone who made it along to our Think Tank conferences this year in both Chicago and London. Both events were buzzing with new faces, new ideas, and new partnerships, and they were a great indication of the health of the channel right now. Hopefully, for those of you who couldn't make it along, today's episode has helped to convey a little of that buzz, and we'll see you at next year's editions. That's all we've got time for in this month's episode, but we'll be back in a few weeks with another edition of Awin Talks. As always, if you'd like to contact us, you can reach us on our dedicated podcast email address, which is awintalks@awin.com. And if you like what you've heard in this episode, then please do give us a 5-star rating or review in the App Store or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.